Got it. Let me start by saying something that really doesn't have that much to do with Passover, which is that as we've gone through this pandemic, and I've had a lot of life challenges, and Christmas is particularly difficult because I remember my daughter Katie and miss all the great times we had together when she was a little kid, and the most sought after Christmas present was a Cabbage Patch doll. I had a client that got me one and I hid it. And like at Red Rider, that Christmas story, I put that one as the last present hidden away. Turns out the little shaver had already found it, but even then she squealed with delight. And I just miss her in all of her aspects. And she was so wonderful. But I want to make 2 points about that. First of all, a lot of the men at Faith Workers were wonderful to me about it and really showed support. So I'm grateful. I also want to say that I'm grateful for the training I got about prayer, because when the worst happens, I just kept praying. And I'm not saying it made it a good time, but it got me through and it allowed me to support other people who were having difficulty with it. So, and that's kind of my segue into the Seder. Now, I'm going to take you back to 1968. Some of you might even remember 1968. And my grandparents had held the Seder at their house at this point for about 30 years. And so, and it was my favorite holiday. And my grandparents had a large apartment by New York standards, but not really. They had a one bedroom, a den, a living room, a dining room, and a small room for a maid or something. My grandmother had to, every Seder, she told my grandfather the limit was 35. And somehow he managed to find four or five other people that we had to sneak in. I think at one point we had some going out in the hallway in the building. So, and just so we're clear, this was not solely a Jewish occasion. There were at least every time, at least five Gentiles, including ministers, priests, people of all sort. But the other thing I want to tell you is that the beginning of Passover, I guess the whole of Passover, is really a religious service. And the most important occasions in Judaism happen in the home. And the most important worship happens in the home, you know, about Sabbath. And we know in the early church that the most important things happened in the home. They call them church homes. And so when we think about the Seder, a lot of people think about the meal. But I got to tell you, if you're going to a traditional Seder, don't go hungry, because there'll be great smells coming from the kitchen, but you'll be lucky if you get the meal within 90 minutes. You got to do a lot of praying before you get to that meal. By the way, when they were trying to convert the slaves to Christianity, they cut out Exodus, which is the Bible, the Book of Freedom. They didn't want them to read that book. And it was forbidden for even Jews to do a Seder service where any persons of color were present, because they didn't want to give them any idea about trying to get out of the United States or get out of Egypt. So now, and I will start, and my the place of my grandfather would have his entire family there and some close friends. And the only thing that marred Passover is it seemed a lot of the times before the men we were ready to sit down, they had to have a business meeting about all the family's businesses. And if one person was particularly not in line, they would tell him. The other thing that did is it left a heavy, heavy, heavy cigar smoke, mostly Havanas. So for a little while during the Seder, you had trouble seeing who was reading. But he would always start out with this admonition that there's going to be a lot of praying. and there should be a lot of praying, but don't limit your praying to this day, this time. And he would always say, prayer feeds the soul. Prayer is the nutrition for the soul. And if you don't feed the soul, there's no point in feeding the body. And he was a founder of something called the SAJ, the Society for the Advancement of Judaism. And what it was Reform Judaism had become very skim milky. That's the only way I can describe it. And he and the guys that founded it believed that there was an importance to ritual. There was importance to prayer rituals to put you in touch with God. You may have a different conception of God, but at least you needed to go through that. There were prescribed rituals. And on his house, he had a mezuzah. And I never saw him coming in or going out. And he had two houses without praying. And he would remind everybody when they would go out the door. And I lived with him for a year while I went to school in Connecticut. And every time he would say, now, did you pray before going out? Are you going to pray when you sit down? You know, you don't have to be out loud, but just remember, God is not confined to the synagogue, the home. He's everywhere. Though he did have some despairing remarks about people who thought that they could reach God on the golf course. He wasn't sure that was the most helpful place. So what he would do as the leader is he would assign reading parts to people, and they would read, and he would tell them what to read. And the idea was that every guest should read, and this was retelling of the story of Passover. But the interesting part about it was that it was a commemoration, but the point was made over and over again that this was not something that had happened 3,000 years ago. This is something that's happening every day. And you have to acknowledge that you need this to happen every day. And at one point in the Passover service, it talks about freedom. But it doesn't just talk about being politically free. It talks about freedom from want, in other words, hunger and other things. It talks about freedom from addiction, for gambling, alcohol, all of those things. And it also talks about the necessity of, and I was talking to my brother about this, that as part of you want to be free from fear, but the only way to be free from fear is to be meek. It goes along with the Beatitudes very nicely, because if you're meek, you can be filled with God, and then you have the power of God inside of you, and basically you have nothing to fear. And that's a point made over and over again during the service. And there would be bread, and the bread would be broken and passed on to each other, in token of what, or actually matzah in this case, the token of what God did for us. And wine would be drunk frequently, but small sips, and blessings would be said. And so, and over again, we would praise God for taking us out of Egypt, and also for all the other bondages which we suffer, either now or in the future. And the idea was that this is not an event that happened 3,000 years ago. This is an ongoing event that is happening. You're still being delivered by God, and you still, as one of the kids, there was a little kid in this group whose name was Jonathan, and he was referred to as Jonathan the Genius. And Jonathan said, oh, I know what you mean is he's going to help us all the time, and we just can't keep needing to ask for help. And my grandfather said, that's right, but you should also thank him for what he's already done and what he is going to do. So then one of the things that would be talked about was, how do you do the remembrance? And Passover at Jesus' time was in part temple based. and the sacrifice of the lamb was to feed the priests. But in Judaism at that point, and by the way, more Jews lived outside of Israel than lived inside of Israel. And my brother has been talking to some archaeologists who are working in Israel, and they now believe that at the time of the 70 AD sacking, there were 150,000 Jewish Christians or followers of the way who went down with the rest of the Jews. And there were also more Jews in Alexandria than there were in Israel. And a great deal of those people converted to Christianity. Now, when I say converted, they didn't see it as a conversion. They saw it as Jesus fulfilling a prophecy. So they saw it as a progression. All right. So one of the discussions was about the children. And see, this service was aimed at children. It was aimed to teach them the omnipresent nature of God, to be thankful to God, and that God is always moving in your life. So yes, it's a commemoration, but it's also a reaffirmation. And it's a reminder that God has made a covenant with us, and we are a covenantal people, and we need to fulfill that covenant. But Greg and I were talking, and he made the excellent point that some people think if they pray too much that they're going to exhaust God, whereas both in the Seder and in Greg's wisdom, that God waits for your prayers. Now, when I say he waits for your prayers, it doesn't mean he always, you know, prays for your horse to come in. You can if you want. It's a lot of prayers, but most of the prayers in Passover are prayers of thanksgiving. Thank you for what you've done. Thank you for all that you've done. Thank you for what you're going to do. And then there were discussed about the four different children and how do you tell these children about Passover. Then the first child they discuss is the wise child, or sometimes read as the wise guy child, and who thought he knows everything. And for him, you need to, first of all, make it to tell him it's not about surface knowledge. It's about really getting the Lord in your presence, and you give him readings, and you basically tell him that no matter how many Passovers you go to, there will always be more to learn, and you always have to be meek with God. The second child is the wicked child, and who doesn't want to believe in anything. And you have to deal with him by explaining to him that without God, there is nothing. And you need to make that point over and over and over again and to do it. The third child is what they call the simple child. And he needs to be told the story in a much simpler way. And you need to make sure while he's hearing it that he's getting the points, and that patience is a virtue, and that if he still isn't getting it through the Seder, that I hate to say this, but you kind of have to, he gets a summer school class to do it. No, but the most interesting child was the fourth child. And the fourth child doesn't understand what's going on. And if you read the commentary in the Mishnah, basically, we were mostly the fourth child. And so with the fourth child, you have to bring this to the immediacy. And you have to tell the fourth child, we are doing this because we are thanking God for what he did when he led me out of Egypt, when he led me out of Egypt. And it's all about what happened to me and me and mine. And to bring it to immediacy. And you're only here for the grace of God. In other words, the child is only here for the grace of God, for what God did for your father, your mother, etc. And then you emphasize the point over and over again that without this God, there is nothing in life, that a life spent away from God is a meaningless life. I know that sounds harsh, but that is the upshot of that. And so that's, and so as when I was talking to my brother about it, who was a very, very faithful Jew, he says that it goes over and over again about the meek shall inherit the earth, because what he says is that blessed are the poor in spirit from the Beatitudes, which means that not that these people are bad or anything, but they're like teapots and they're not full of stuff. They're empty so they can be filled with God. And that point is made over and over again in the Passover service, that the only way to get God is to empty it out and not be overcome with your own wealth, rituals, beliefs in yourself, the ego, I guess would be what they would call it now. So that's an important part. And then it also talks about your duties because of this great thing that was done to you. And because God has showed you grace, and if you accept God's grace, then you need to honor that inheritance by helping the needy, helping other people, and helping the poor in spirit, which means that people who are away from God need to be helped back to God, not as some sort of a torture, but as a full actualization of their life. If you like Maslow's pyramid, that would be on top and then on the bottom. All right, so the other part of the service is there are many rituals, and the rituals involve, oh, first of all, I'll do this. The rituals involve food, but before this, there's a what is called the four questions. Now, the four questions are supposed to be read by the youngest child that can read. So, and the child who's got this responsibility will spend many hours practicing. And if he's really good, he'll ask them both in Hebrew and in English. So one of the first questions is, and by the way, each question is answered by a different guest. And the reason for that is that they want everybody to be involved in this function of worship. This is not a top-down function where the rabbi, the priest, sits there and preaches and everybody sort of lays back and gets ready to tell whether or not the priest did it right or the minister or the rabbi. So you have a responsibility in the service. And so the first one is, why is this night different from all other nights? And it says, on this night we eat neither bread, we eat only matzah. And then the next question, on all other nights we eat herbs of any kind. Why on this night do we eat only bitter herbs? And all other nights we do not dip our herbs even once. Why on this night do we dip them twice? And on all other nights we eat sitting and standing with erect posture. Why on this night do we eat while leaning? And the matzah, and I'm not going to read the whole answers because I don't want anybody falling asleep. Matzah is the symbol of our affliction and our freedom. Legend has it that when Moses and his followers fled Egypt, they moved so quickly that the bread they baked did not have time to rise. And that the point of this was that this unleavened bread was nourishing, but in order to preserve freedom, you had to leave, and you had to leave quickly. And there's an underlying message that if you can get too attached to your material goods, whether it be baked bread or other delicacies, that you can lose God. Tradition says that this root, the bitter herbs, is to remind us of the time of our slavery. We force ourselves to taste pain so that we may more readily value pleasure. The bitter herbs were eaten at the spring festival in ancient times. So, and it also reminds us that the stimulus of life, too. So you have to remember that Passover is a spring festival. And Passover would happen exactly at the same time as Easter, except for the fact that the Christians adopted a solar calendar and the Jews had a lunar calendar. And so it moves around. But this was the spring planting festival. And then the dipping, the first time, the salty taste reminds us of the tears we cried when we were slaves. The second time, the salt water and the green help us to remember the ocean and green plants and the earth from which we get air, water, and food that enable us to live. And also to remind us of God's grace in giving us these plants and the ability to live, and that life comes from God and is a gift. And you need to honor that gift and to deal with it. Now, I'm going to go into the last one, but one particular, and this is the reason I'm going back to 1968, we were already living in the Midwest, but I was all excited about flying in for Passover and sitting next to my gramps. And none of you have met Samuel Poses, but I won't go into my rhapsodies about him. But he was one of the most unusual people and a person, a natural born leader, but a leader who's was a servant leader and did everything he could as the head of the family, which at that point he had some responsibility for 60 human beings, was to make life better for them. It wasn't that they paid him tribute. So that particular night, on his right side, there was a gentleman sitting there. And this gentleman was a cousin. I can't tell you whose cousin it was. By the way, he was also sitting next to the man referred to as Archie the cab driver, who was a Irish Catholic relative of my grandmother who owned a cab fleet. And I didn't find out he owned a cab fleet until later. I thought he just had one cab he drove. But anyway, this poor kid was probably 21, 22, had been a pilot in Vietnam, and he had been shot down over Hue and had been taken to a hospital in Japan. And he was what they call a moaner, which means he made a lot of noise, not on purpose. Just a lot of pain. So the nurses kept increasing the amount of Demerol he was getting. And to the point when the army released him, he was a Demerol addict. And, you know, they basically said, you're free. Now you got to do something about this addiction. I heard of the word dereliction of duty. I think the army was derelict in its duty. So, but luckily for him, he had a loving family. And members of the family would take turns being with him and talking him through. It takes a year to totally get rid of a Demerol addiction. And so he was brought there because everybody in the family was going to be there, but also so that prayers could be said over him and so that he could know that God was with him and the family was with him. And then we were going to free him from his own personal bondage to addiction. And I won't go into all the things that they did, but about halfway through the service, he started crying and just almost keening. And people came over and touched him and blessed him. And my grandfather said after that Passover, he had the strength to work with the members of the family to kick the Demerol. And the reason I'm telling you that story is because what I don't think people understand is that a properly done Passover service is a profound religious event. And in some ways, it foreshadows the resurrection of Christ, because the idea of Passover is that you recommit yourself to God, thank God for what he's done, and come out a much holier, cleaner person, ready to worship God and to enlist God and to honor God. So it's a partial resurrection, because the idea is you should not come out as the same person you went in. So anyway, and the last thing is, and I always got a kick out of this, and on this night we are allowed to recline. Why on all other nights do we have to sit up straight? And we were told, the question goes back to ancient times in Rome, when it was a custom for rich people to eat while lying on a couch, leaning on one elbow, as slaves and servants fed them. The Jewish people threw out this relaxed type of eating as a sign of freedom, so they would learn lean to one side and eat at the Seder table and the Festival of Freedom. And today we're free to eat while sitting up, even at Passover, but the question remains in the service, as it reminds us of how it was when our people longed for freedom. It also reminds us that who is feeding us? And if nobody knows the answer by now, I've really been a bad speaker. It's God. And the Passover service tells the entire story of the Exodus, and it has multiple singing, which I will not inflict on you. And Dayenu knew what God did for us. And so when this concludes and there's a wine is drunk, the wine is always in remembrance of the fact that God has done all these things for us. God will do great things for us, and God is doing great things for us, and that God is available to us at all times and in all places. And all the, in order for us to, Elie Wiesel said, in order for us to be filled with God, which is should be our natural state, we have to decrease so that he can increase. In other words, put aside your petty egos and all of that. And so at one Passover meal when I was younger, around 1960, I don't remember which one of the relatives came in from out of town, not one we normally saw. And after the meal, she started criticizing some things about the meal. And my Uncle Herman, who was my grandfather's brother, went up to her and said, "Have you been paying no attention? This is not about a meal. If you're not satisfied with a meal, we'll take you over to the Waldorf. This is about being filled with God. And if you've, with given your attitude, you have to have not been filled with God." And he said, "And I'm assigning you 20 pages of scripture to read to discuss with me next week." But yeah, they didn't want any cattiness. I mean, this, so many people want to make this about the food. The food, of course, is a sacrifice that we show to God, and we're eating and partaking of it. And basically, we're partaking of God's body that he has given to us. And therefore, it is ungrateful not to understand that the central message of Passover and the Exodus is what God has done for us, what will he do, and that we need to remember at Passover, but in all times, God is doing things for us. Now, of course, this being a spring festival, it was a planting festival. So it was also a way of saying that we need God's help for a good crop, for a good life. And the last point I want to make is that while the adults participated, everything was aimed at the children. And sometimes there would be multiple passages read multiple ways so that the children would understand it. And it was the duty of the parent before they came to educate them excuse me, and then it was the duty of the parent or whatever the older class was to ask the children questions about it and remind them for 7 days of what had happened and tried to keep that foremost in their minds. Now, if you were a good Jew, at every meal, you would remind people of what God has done for you. And then on the Sabbath, you would break the bread, which was the challah, and the wine in honor of what God has done for you. So that was every Friday night. By the way, do you know why there are so many Orthodox Jews? Not a joke. In Orthodox Judaism, it is said that the woman needs to lie with the man on either Friday night or Saturday morning. It's her sacred duty. So, as you can imagine, that leads to a lot of children. When I heard about that, was the only time I was tempted to stopping a Reconstructionist Jew or a Christian and maybe be an Orthodox Jew for a couple weeks. Anyway, I want to leave you guys with this, that Passover is a celebration of God. It's a celebration of freedom. But Rabbi Kaplan would say, yes, we were let out of slavery, but the slavery is a symbolic thing, and that in all generations, we try to enslave ourselves with, I don't know, for some reason, he was obsessed with the members of the congregation that would buy Cadillacs. Not that there was anything wrong with a Cadillac, but they would get so excited, and when the Cadillac didn't come, they right away, they'd be so disappointed. And so he always talked about humility, and he used the words decreasing to allow God to increase. So also, he would say that the Passover and other holidays is to show us our proper relationship in the universe, that God is the big kahuna and we are the little bits. But the great thing about it is that we are allowed to communicate with the big white guy. And unlike, you know, if you're in a school or something where the bully is always going to beat on you, in this case, the strongest and most important, and that's an understatement, is on your side, and you never need to forget it. And he would say you need to pray unceasingly. And so somebody said, well, how do you pray when you build a door? He said, well, as you hit each nail in, thank God that the nail went straight. So he was a big believer that you could bring God into everyday tasks. And he didn't say God only existed on Sunday. So because of being Jewish, he said, let's not be Friday night and Saturday morning Jews. Let's be the Jews that were intended. And on every Jewish household, there's supposed to be a sign, that a mikvah, that sign that shows that you remind you that the God is there and that you should pray as you come in and as you go out. All right, I think I've spoken. I'm not bad. I'm 7 minutes over. So since I haven't spoken in a couple months, it's probably all right. We have a bunch of questions there. Chris did a good job of rewriting them. But what I'm trying to get at is, how do you see Passover as a significance, or the Exodus and significance, with the later coming of Jesus? And in some ways, I feel that in many ways, that the coming of Jesus is really fulfilling the story of the Exodus and Passover, because in Jesus, we see the great thing about the incarnation is that we now have someone to identify with. We can feel the presence of God. And when we think of Jesus, knowing that he was a man, it's much easier for us to identify with and pray. And as I mentioned before, when Greg and I were talking, there really is a power in the name of Jesus. I have to do some god-awful exercises for my back and hips and whatever part of me that's falling apart this week. And I always find they go much better if I repeat, Jesus loves me, Jesus is healing me, Jesus is helping me. And it just works. And so I think not that this group needs it, but I go around preaching that there's a power in the name. And but also to remember that supplication prayer is the least of the prayers. At Passover, it would be made over and over again clear that the most important prayer is a prayer of thanksgiving. Thank you, God, for what you've done in my life. And when somebody would say, oh, that's a pain in the ass because I got to take care of so-and-so or my kid is sick. And my grandfather would turn to him and say, oh, great, you have an opportunity for service to show your faith in God. No mercy there. All right, I've spoken enough. I hope that I made some good points and that you learned something.